Hi, everyone. It's your host, Matilda, Dizzy,
and Imama.
And you're listening to the Africa Lipso podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Africa Lipso podcast. Today, we have a special guest with us. We have Mr. Tayo Bello. He is a historian and an artist, and also a very, to me anyways, on my TikTok, very popular TikToker and YouTuber. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Good and happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Tayo, how's your week been?
It's been eventful and productive.
Wait, did you say unproductive or
and productive?
Okay, I was like, oh, that's the test.
What made it eventful?
I granted an interview.
Ooh. Well, with the celeb right now.
I beg.
Oh, who was the interview with?
It's with a radio station, actually, a local radio station here in Ibadan.
Oh, nice.
Nice. I think your content is very, very appealing because it's things that we never really hear much about. Okay, so history lesson. On my TikTok, I was just scrolling once and then I saw one of your videos. I think you were talking about, I think it was the Moi Moi one. I was like, huh? Because I'm Yoruba as well. But there's just so much that you talk about that I feel like isn't normal discourse.
We don't know what he talks about, so maybe he can tell us what exactly.
That's what I was going to go into. So you could tell us a little bit about what you talk about and then how you came to this kind of content. Yeah.
I talk about Africa, specifically Yoruba. You understand? I talk about, and when I say I talk about Yoruba, I mean not just Yoruba as a people, but as a religion too. Our mythologies, mm-hmm. You know, talk about the Orisha. Eshu, Oya, Ogun, Shongo. I also talk about our proverbs and our history, you know, what we were like before in the pre-colonial days. I branch into our history too, politically now, our modern history, post-colonial history, and also stories about Africa, just things to inform us about who we are, where we are coming from, and to let people understand the fact that we do have a history. We do have a history, actually, and it's very rich, you understand? I talk about our poetry. The Yoruba language is very beautiful, and it's quite unique. And I'm speaking objectively, it's quite very unique. Mm-hmm. And we can't even scratch the surface of it in 10 lifetimes. So I can only do the little I can. And it's been interesting so far.
Oh, that is really cool, actually.
Yeah. I saw somewhere that you have a training in theatrical arts. Do you think that kind of informed your love for it? Definitely.
I grew up with my grandmother in my hometown, although I was born in Lagos, at Jegunle. I don't know if you know the place or if you've heard of it.
Yeah.
Come on. I think the whole Nigeria, Jegunle is very popular. A lot of like music comes out of there and stuff. So.
Exactly.
Then come man, then kill man, oh, for instance.
Exactly. That's it.
That'll be the first
I literally grew up with that song.
That is too funny.
Those are the songs we grew up with.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when did you go to your hometown? At what age?
At 14, I left at Jegunle. I was staying with my grandmother who was old and she needed help. And
okay.
So I had my senior secondary school in my hometown. So as from there, I proceeded to OAU, Obafemi Awolowo University. And that is where I studied dramatic arts, which began the whole job, actually.
Oh, really? How did dramatic arts transform into Yoruba culture studying?
A lot of what we do in Ife is traditional. A lot of the plays, you know, we were introduced to playwrights like Soyinka or Larutimi, Wale Ogunyemi, and a lot of what these guys do are actually rich in mythology. And these are the pioneers of African literature, and they even adapted some of Achebe's works into drama, into plays, and we acted them out. The songs we sang. You know, the places we visited, and Ife itself being a place very rich in culture, specifically Yoruba, and it just helped. And dramatic art being something I'm very passionate about also made it easy.
Question: have you always wanted to study dramatic arts? Like, even from like, what influenced your choice? I guess.
I just the thing is, I started reading the works of Olarotimi very early, I think around age 9, 10, 11, I was already reading Olarotimi. There was this super story then. I don't know if you know about
this. It's a super story.
Exactly. So super story featured Olarotimi's Gods Are Not to Blame. And then it is so beautiful. And I was very young. I was just a kid. I loved it so much. And my elder sister actually had the Gods Are Not to Blame in our ex syllabus. So I had access to the play. And then I read it and fell in love with the man. A lot of Olarotimi's plays, as intellectual as they are, they can still be read by kids and they can still be understood, even by kids. So I began reading Olarotimi. I just knew I was going to do drama because I wanted to write plays like that too. And the only way that would happen was for me to study theater. So from there, I just knew that this is what I'm going to do.
Have you continued to act or write plays?
Being a shy person, I don't do a lot of acting. I majored in directing in school, and I write, just playwrights and directing. I do very less of acting.
Okay, we're looking forward to seeing your work. Have you already published work?
I haven't. We're working towards it very soon.
You know, very soon. We shall be your accountability partner. I don't know how you're working with accountable now, but don't worry.
We do that a lot. Like when Fuad was on the podcast and he was talking about how he was going to write something about his travels, because we had someone on that had traveled all the states in Nigeria, and he hadn't like compiled it as of then. I think he has kind of now. I'll look for it and share. But yes, we will be your accountability partners.
That'd be helpful.
Oh, and fun fact that I found out actually looking into you, and I feel like I stalk all that, I guess, but but your dad is Nigerian and your mom is Togolese, right?
Yeah.
That's the same for me too.
Are you serious?
Yeah, my dad is Yoruba. My mom is technically half Togolese. Her dad is Togolese, but her mom is Nigerian. But like, wow. I was like, that's so interesting.
Wow.
I did have the question of, I guess you grew up in Nigeria, but do you also have Togolese influence in your life? Like, have you been there? Do you know about the culture there? And what made you more curious about Yoruba culture as opposed to like Togolese culture?
Okay, first of all, I'm also equally curious about Togolese culture. It's just that I've had more of Yoruba influence than Togolese influence. The place where we grew up in Lagos, that place has a lot of Togolese people, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
There are a lot of Togolese people in Nigeria, by the way.
Especially in Lagos. There are so many in Lagos. So I never really felt like I wasn't with my mother's people. Our relatives were there, and occasionally we were taken to Togo. Although the last time I was there was 2015, which is very long ago.
Me too!
Not you guys being twins.
I actually went there for the first time in 2015. So, I mean, but yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. So, the thing is, my mother actually happens to be, she's Togolese, but then she's, how do I put it now? She's among the Yorubas in Togo. The Yorubas who don't call themselves Yorubas. In Togo, I learned that, you know, they are just as we have a branch of the Yoruba people in Benin Republic, in Ghana, we have the Eve people in Togo actually have their origin in the, they're actually like a sibling of the Yoruba people.
I'm going to scream
because my mom is actually Eve as well, but yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So, and I've seen some similarities in their language, especially in their religion. The way we do Orisha Ibeji here, they do that, and they call it what we call it, although there are some alterations in the pronunciations.
For instance, how do they pronounce it?
Elegbara Eshu. Eshu is called Elegbara here. Over there, they called him Legba. So that is too similar to be coincidental. And some other similarities there, even in our culture, the way we greet, the way we worship our deities, that's exactly how they do it there. You understand? So I'm actually looking forward to being able to, you know, go there, stay there for some while, learn about their culture and their history, because I know very little about it. I speak the language, but not as fluently as I speak Yoruba. Yeah. My mother, because the people are there, my mother speaks the language to us. Even my father can't speak the language.
Yeah.
Even as a Yoruba. So there's still more to come about Togo. I'm very, very fascinated about...
Okay, I'm looking forward to that. Wait,
quick question for Matilda and Tayo. Are both your moms like fully Togolese?
Yes. My mother is fully Togolese.
It's fully. Okay, mine is half. My mom speaks the language as well, but she never taught us because I think she uses it to speak with her sister when they are trying to code gist. Because we understand Yoruba. So like sometimes she'd be speaking on the phone and they'll be speaking in Yoruba. And when they're about to get into gist, they'll now switch. So I think, I almost think it was intentional. Yeah, I wish I learned it. And I guess maybe it's not too late, as you said. Like, I do want to get to know more about that part of my heritage. But yeah.
It isn't. The Togolese culture is very beautiful. Have you seen their dances?
The dance music, with the shoulder thing.
The shoulder dance and the songs, the drumming. It's just very beautiful. I can't wait to, you know, get myself immersed in that aspect of African culture.
Let's go, Togolese buddy. That's pretty cool. I barely meet any Togolese people, actually, which is interesting. Maybe they don't leave West Africa as much as like Nigerians, maybe.
Yeah, they are not as they are not as nomadic as a lot of us here in Nigeria.
Yeah, but narrowing it down and going back to like, you know, why we wanted to have you on, I think from looking at your TikToks, I just realized we don't know that much about what Yoruba land was as of when it was probably in its full swing. So we were hoping that you could help us paint a good picture of what like prehistoric Yoruba land was and the cultures and just what the people were like. And because of your rich amount of knowledge, we thought you'd be the perfect guest. So first of all, can you give us like a background of where the Yoruba people are from and, you know, how they came to be known as Yoruba people?
Okay. First of all, the term Yoruba is not Yoruba. It is... it has no meaning in our language. Although some have tried to be creative, they have tried to, you know, Yorubanize it. They have tried to give it a lot of Yoruba meaning. Some say I want one Yoruba and all that. But historically, we aren't given that name, which is normal. What people are called isn't really given to them by themselves. It's always foreigners who give them the names. For instance, okay, the Yoruba people now. And when we say Yoruba, even when we were called Yoruba, it wasn't for all. Now, if you say Yoruba, we are talking about southwestern Nigeria. But in the pre-colonial days, it wasn't so. It was a term used specifically for the Oyo, you understand?
Mm.
Yeah, for the Oyo. And when you want pay Yoruba, sorry. So those are the Oyo people. Yeah, they are the ones called Yoruba. And that was given to them by their neighbors in the northern aspect of that region. The Baruba people, they were the ones who called the Oyo Yoruba. We don't know the meaning now, it is lost. But based on what I've read so far, it isn't derogatory, as a lot of people like to claim. Some people have given it different meanings. Some people have said, you know, they are dishonest people, and that's what it means, and all that. No. We have an early, we have a Fulani reference, and that is Yariba. Now, the Fulani heard it from those people, and that is the way they pronounced it, Yariba. If you go to Barotin, the northern aspect of Kwara State today, where we have Ibariba people, you still hear them calling Yoruba people Yorubu. It's actually Yoru, and the plural for Yoru is Yorubo, you know. Now, Ajayi Crowther and the missionaries.
I know that guy. sorry, Tayo, please continue your story.
Okay, the missionaries, to make the administration easier, they had to amalgamate the southwestern ethnic groups. We had Yoruba, we had the Egba, the Ilesha. We had Awori and all that, but they gathered everybody together. And one thing they did that led to the kind of Yoruba we speak today is the translation of the Bible into the Yoruba language. Ajayi Crowther translated the Bible into Yoruba language. So he literally he mainly translated it into the Oyo Yoruba. The thing is, we never really considered ourselves the same people, although we were the same people. We recognize the fact that we have a common ancestry, we recognize Odudu as our progenitor, but we never really considered ourselves the same people in that sense. We considered ourselves separate nations, independent nations, and we even waged war against each other. We had allies among ourselves, we had enemies among ourselves, we even sold each other to slavery, sadly. So but with the advent of the Yoruba Bible, nothing really connects people more than religion, you understand?
Yeah.
So when we began having Yoruba converts started reading the Bible, that was the unifying factor. And it was at that time that Yoruba started being used for the whole of southwestern Nigeria, you understand? So that basically is our history. We have always considered ourselves to be the same people, but not really the same people. It's just like many European countries today who might, you know, have originated from a common ancestry and all that, but they are separate nations in their own rights. That is how we were. But today, we are Yoruba. And if you look at our, if you really examine the Yoruba people, you see wide differences. You see a huge difference between the Ilaje people and the Oyo, for instance. The Egba, even the Egba and the Jebo, as close as they are, they still have their very diverse ways of doing things. And the language, the dialects, when you examine those dialects, you see that sometimes they even have no similarity at all.
Yeah.
In the way they are being spoken. If you take, for instance, the Ife dialect and the Jebu dialect together, you struggle to find similarities there. But
really?
We are still going to get some.
I recall going home, because we go back to the village a lot. And when they speak Ijebu at me, I literally cannot understand what they are saying.
I literally cannot understand too. So it's a proof that we were actually separate peoples, although we had a common ancestry. We had common ancestry, and Odudu himself is more of a mythological character than historical. You understand? So,
so I guess, is this similar to like the way there's Latin and then you have French, English, and the other, I forgot what they call it now, the branch.
The break out of it, yeah.
Yeah, okay, makes sense.
Exactly. So, and the thing about us is our history is preserved mostly orally, and so a lot has been lost. That's why we have so many people with their own versions today. Everybody wants to have his own version of history. Everybody wants to have his own meaning of the Yoruba, the word Yoruba, and all that. But we still have ample literature that can still guide us. We have some intellectuals like Toyin Falola, for instance. He's done a good job of, you know, providing our history for us, letting us know where we come from. And if people are sincere enough and they are serious enough to just find out the truth, they are going to find out the truth.
Wait, I have a question. All this, like, I guess, like, knowledge and, like, information that you have about the Yoruba culture, like, how did you acquire them? Because, like, I mean, to my knowledge, and honestly, my knowledge is not that vast, there is, like, not that much documentation of our history. So I guess, like, I was wondering how you got your information based on, like, the lack of documentation we have on Nigeria / like Yoruba history.
And like also for some things are hard to Google just also because not many people write about it. And like I know someone who has like some records are kept in like historical, let's say there's a king lineage essentially, and they'll only keep certain documents within their household or something. Like things are just not in one place. So just adding on to Imama's comment, I'm also curious as well.
To answer the first question, growing up in my hometown helped a lot. Because while in Ajegunle, I was never concerned about Yoruba. You can't be in Ajegunle and have such concerns anyway. So.
There are greater concerns here.
It's not possible. So I wasn't even able to speak the Yoruba language properly, although I didn't know that.
Really?
Until I went to a very Yoruba town, like my hometown in Nisha. That was when I knew that I couldn't speak Yoruba. And so the people made jest of me a lot. Whenever I spoke, they just like to make jest of me. They just laugh. And I was like a comedian to them, even to my grandmother, to everybody. The kind of Yoruba we speak was so funny to them.
Was it like broken to them, like broken English almost?
Exactly.
Is that what they sounded like?
Oh. Exactly. Instead of saying muti law, you say miti law. And even the tone, the intonation was... It was just so funny to them. And you know, Lagos did especially Ajegunle. It has a lot of Yoruba people, but you know, it equally has a lot of Igbo people, a lot of Hausa people. So it doesn't really operate as a proper Yoruba society.
Okay.
That's interesting because I feel like a lot of, and I mean, I guess for context, like I'm Igbo here. I'm Igbo and Edo, so I'm not Yoruba. And a lot of people that I know that are in Lagos or that operate in Lagos, Ajegunle, Lagos Island, wherever it is, it's like they almost have to learn how to speak Yoruba to properly integrate into those societies. Like, for instance, like my mom has like shops in Lagos Island and in Ikeja, and she speaks Yoruba fluently because she has to kind of like do business and like integrate mm-hmm. with those societies. So I guess like, and also like a lot of Igbo people that I have also met, because like I also have like some family that does business around Lagos, they also have to had to learn. Please, it's not funny.
Yes, I'm like, you are Igbo, of course.
Yes, but anyway, scream. I have a family that has done business like, you know, around Lagos, and essentially they also kind of had to like learn Yoruba. So it's kind of like interesting that the fact that there were other cultures or whatever it is in Ajegunle meant that the Yoruba was not as,
language is not diminished in any form. It is still a major mm-hmm. language in Lagos. You know, mm-hmm. Lagos still has more of Yoruba than any other ethnic group. It's a Yoruba land, so. But Lagos is the only Yoruba state where Pidgin English is the official language. And that's because we don't have just Yorubas there. You understand?
Mm,
we have a considerable amount of non-Yorubas in Lagos. And even the Yoruba we speak in Lagos is not in its pure form. Mm. It's been compromised, it's been adulterated. It's not really the kind of Yoruba people speak here in Ibadan, for instance, or in Oshogbo, you know. And so when you come from Oshogbo and you speak Yoruba, they make jest of you. They laugh at you. They say, yeah, Yoruba is too deep, it's too local. And when you come from Lagos and you speak Yoruba in Oshogbo, they make jest of you. They say your Yoruba is too shallow.
Too posh.
so that was
There's a lot of mixing with English as well in Lagos.
Exactly. There's a lot of mixing with English. A lot of lost vocabulary, actually. Yeah. There are some words I never heard until I left Lagos. I couldn't imagine. How would people... Even the use of the word coda, for instance. Coda is bot. But who uses that? Until I got to places like Oshogbo, and that was a nice... people actually spoke like this. I thought this language was supposed to be in books alone. People actually speak like this in reality. Growing up in Lagos has made the proper Yoruba sound ancient. You know, you almost can't imagine that people still
like
speak
Shakespearean.
That. Exactly, exactly. Makes it sound so Shakespearean and all that. So when I got to my hometown, that actually began the journey. I learned Yoruba properly. I was able to, you know, my grandmother she couldn't even speak English, so there was no other way. I had to understand what she was saying. And I wasn't even consciously trying to learn the language. It just happened osmotically because, I mean, that was the only language I had to speak with. And even in school, and I'm lucky because it's no longer like that today. But then in school, if you wanted to write in Yoruba, because we offered Yoruba and it was compulsory for everybody, if you write Yoruba without Amiung, it is automatic failure. However, brilliant.
What's Amiu?
The accent. If you see the Yoruba language, you are going to see some markings on top of the letters and all that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that's what it was.
Wow, called. Hadiza, honestly, I'm feeling better than you at this point.
No, but I never took Yoruba in school, though. I only watched Yoruba movies. No, I took Hausa.
Even
was
in junior secondary?
No, I took Hausa.
Oh, interesting.
She was in Abuja.
I was in Abuja,
no, that makes sense, yeah. Because I guess, like, us was compulsory until we got to senior secondary.
But it's crazy because in SEF, we were not required to put Amiohu on everything. And that's why I was always first in Yoruba, because if they required that, that's where they'll lose me. But yeah.
Yeah, so I was forced to learn Amiohu. I was forced, literally. Because I would write something and it would make sense and I would still get zero. And the man will flog us. You know, the man will flog us. He will whip us, actually.
Wow.
Give me trauma.
I just had to learn it. And I just noticed that I know this thing. You know, you just realize, you know, the way you just realize that, wow, I know this thing now. You got a kind of thing. So, and the books we read helped a lot. We read Egun Alare. The Yoruba books we read in secondary school actually were so rich in language, the poetry, the beauty. I began appreciating the Yoruba language. I began seeing the beauty. And this is one thing. I had a father and an uncle who were very Yoruba. and they were very Yoruba and they're almost fanatic about it. And the one thing you can do to annoy them or to make them irritated is to speak the Yoruba language in a bad way. My uncle, I was fond of always pausing music, pausing songs and asking us, okay, maybe he's listening to Ayinla Omogura or Barista, or he would just pause it and say, wait, one pani ben, kini itumo away. That is that
my proverb. God, that's annoying.
That wait, sorry. What does that mean?
I mean, that proverb there, what does it mean? So he would ask us, that proverb that man has said now, what does it mean? And then you just start looking at the man, you know, dumbfounded, and he's just like, ah. And they literally get annoyed, which is strange. Why would you get annoyed? Why are you annoyed?
So, actually, question on that. So we have Ashake, and I feel like let me land. I feel like what people usually say is, oh, Ashake's Yoruba is stronger than our usual. So from your own perspective, is he also just mid like everybody else? Like the Yoruba he speaks.
If you talk about Ashake, okay, now Ashake and I were classmates in university.
No way!
Proximity!
Come on.
We studied dramatic art together. Yeah, he studied dramatic art there. Although he ran a diploma program, so he graduated before me. So his was a 2-year program, mine was 4 years. So I've always known Ashake to be phenomenal. That guy, he hasn't even started anything at all. For those of us that knew him, that guy is just, he's just starting. Yoruba will say Ashake Moye Bolakun. I mean, he's just beginning. Ashake has so much to give us. Ashake is the only person whose drumming has almost put me in the state of trance. And I'm speaking very seriously. When Ashake is on the drum, he's so spiritual. That guy is loaded. And when he speaks,
he's like,
that's sick.
I saw him in a Yoruba movie, so it kind of makes sense.
For real, it's crazy. When Ashake speaks, and it's almost, you almost can't expect somebody like that to exist in this generation. You understand? And he has a very, his background is in Lagos Island, Saleko. That alone speaks a lot, speaks volumes about what he's doing today. So, Ashake hasn't really started at all. And the kind of plays we read together in school, the kind of Yoruba, for instance, there was a play we did, Yabale Laje. That's the title of the play. That means the Bale's wife is a witch. Yabale Laje. That play is pure Yoruba. You can't do something like that and then speak Yoruba, you know, in a shallow way. You understand? Okay. You can't be weaned on the product of Olesho Inka, for instance. You couldn't have performed in Jankari War or Death and the King's Husband, and then your Yoruba is ordinary. You understand?
Okay. So Ashake is also giving us a taste of what real Yoruba is, basically.
No, definitely, definitely. Okay. And he's doing a perfect job of blending it with, you know, Amapiano, and you know, he has modernized something ancient, and that is very beautiful.
Sick. Wow. Now I've become a super fan, if I wasn't before.
You haven't mark my words. You haven't seen Ashake. You haven't seen Ashake. He hasn't really even danced. You know, the dances he's doing are too simple. He hasn't really danced. He hasn't really gone into tradition. Ashake, for instance, let me share this story. There was this Shango performance we had in school then. And so Shango is always played by somebody tall. Directors always like to choose somebody very tall and elegant and all that. But this particular director decided to use Ashake as his own Shango. People were like, why would you use Ashake? Because Ashake doesn't have the height and all that. And then he isn't much of a good speaker like that. When it comes to acting, he does more of drumming and dancing and singing. But Ashake did Shango. My God. People were crying. If you watch Shango, the kind of emotion that, you know, is drawn out from the audience is mostly vivacious. You're very lively. And for somebody to play Shango, and instead of people to be shouting, and people were shouting and they were crying at the same time. This is God. That guy is mad, though. no. The guy is crazy. It's almost indescribable. I don't know how to explain it. You have to see it for yourself. You have to see Ashake dance, you know. I mean, traditional dance. You have to see him drum. When he drums, he screams. He screams. He takes off his shirt and he shouts. And that alone makes you feel what he's doing. He puts his soul into everything he does. That guy is crazy. Sincerely, don't worry. Just watch out for me.
Well, Hadiza has already been sold on Asake. So.
You don't even know. I don't even speak Yoruba, but why do I know his lyrics?
That's amazing. But taking it back to where the Yoruba land was, I thought Oyo played a very big part in the unification of like the Yoruba states and stuff, because there was an empire, right?
Yeah, in fact, Oyo is referred to as the Yoruba proper. And the Yoruba we speak today is actually Oyo.
Okay.
Understand? The Yoruba we speak today now is Oyo. That owes also to the fact that the Bible was translated to the Oyo Yoruba, although with some modifications to include the Egba and one spoken in Lagos and all that. But mainly, any Yoruba that is being spoken today anywhere in the world is the Oyo Yoruba. The Oyo was the Oyo Empire was actually the only empire in southwestern Nigeria in the pre-colonial times. And a lot of all these other ethnic groups were actually subservient to the Oyo. They were either allies or serfs of the Oyo Empire.
Okay.
And the Alaafin was Alaafin had more political influence than even the Oni. Oni has a spiritual significance. Alaafin had a political significance. So politically, it had always been Oyo. And when the Europeans claimed to have contacts with the Yoruba and all that, it was always Oyo they are referring to.
Okay.
And that's why we say that Adishebi Oyo Lari, Oyo Shebi Wabeniko. I'm sorry.
What was the political structure like? You kind of already briefly went into it, but how were the individual states ruled and then also in the grand scheme of the Oyo Empire?
Okay. Firstly, it was a democratic monarchy that was practiced. Then we had the just as we have the executive, judiciary, and legislature. That was how it. That was how it was then too. We had the Alaafin, was the head of the executive. The Alaafin was the monarch, the king. He was called Alasha Ikeji Orisha. That is, his second only to the gods. He's that powerful. He could order for the head of anybody. You understand? But then his powers were still checked by the Oyomesi, who made him king in the first place. It was the Oyomesi. The Oyomesi is headed.
Who's the Oyomesi?
Okay, the Oyomesi is a group of ministers, and they have a prime minister who is called the Bashorun. Bashorun himself means there is a festival in the old Oyo Empire called Orun. Orun means heaven, right?
Yes.
So there's a festival of Orun. Literally, they were paying homage to the forces of heaven and all that. Now, the one who presides over their festival is called Oshorun. And Iba is Yoruba word for Lord. Oba is Yoruba word for King. Iba is Yoruba word for Lord. So we had Iba Oshorun, that is the Lord who performs the Orun festival. Iba Oshorun, and that is what becomes Bashorun today.
Okay.
A similar word to it is Balogun. Ogun is Yoruba word for Ogun is Yoruba word for war. Right, so we have Iba. Iba is Lord. So the Lord at war, or the commander at war, is Balogun. Iba Logun. Iba Oshorun. Bashorun. So the Bashorun was the head of the Oyomesi. The Oyomesi is a council of ministers. They actually appoint the king. Kingship in those days wasn't really as hereditary as it is today. The fact that you are the king's first son doesn't automatically make you the king. I mean, the next king. Yeah. So you are still subject to the approval of the Oyomesi. So the Oyomesi come together, the Bashorun, the consult Ifa, and they actually consider a lot of political issues and some political considerations before they can appoint the next king. So as powerful as the Alaafin was, it couldn't be power drunk, although we had some despotic kings too. But that was always in connivance with the Oyomesi. Without the cooperation of the Oyomesi, no king could be tyrannical. You understand?
Mm.
So now the Oyomesi himself is checked upon by the Ogboni. The Ogboni today has been, that word itself has been demonized. It's been made diabolical and all that. But historically, it wasn't so. Ogboni himself, when in Yoruba land, Gbo means to be old or to be advanced or to be mature. Gbo. Now, Ogboni is person. So a person that is advanced, that is old, or that is experienced is Ogboni. Eni to Gbo. So that is where we have Ogboni. You understand? Mm-hmm. So just merely looking at that word, there's nothing diabolical about it. You understand?
Right.
So we have Ogboni. The Ogbonis, that's also a council. They check the excesses of the Oyomesi. So just as the Oyomesi checks the Alaafin, the Ogboni checks the Oyomesi. If there is any need, for instance, when a king is too despotic, the Ogboni actually demands for his suicide, and the king must commit suicide. Mm. Yeah.
Wow, that is interesting.
The king mustn't be killed by somebody else because the people regard him as an Orisha himself. They call him Allah Shekeji Orisha. So killing the king himself is like joy, is putting a curse upon your own head. So he has to ritual kill himself. He has to commit suicide by his own self.
Okay. Wow.
It was a very organized system of government, highly organized. Nothing was left to chance. The Yoruba culture itself is very systematized. Everything, there is a way you do everything. There is something you must do for anything that happens. There is a way you can name, there is a way you must name a child if he is born in a particular way. There is actually nothing. When it comes to childbirth, for instance, there is no circumstance around childbirth that the Yoruba doesn't have a way of dealing with it. And even the name for that kind of child. You understand? Mm-hmm. For the twins, for the triplets, you know, the child born on the roadside, the one born when the father is dead, the one born before the father died, or the one born after the father has died. So it's a very, very detailed culture we are talking about here. But politically, it was very organized too. For instance, we had the Onare Onokakanfo. The Onare Onokakanfo is the generalissimo, the field marshal, the highest ranking military personnel.
So, I thought that was the Bashorun.
No, no, Bashorun is the head of the Oyomesi.
Okay.
So we had the Are Onokakanfo. The Are Onokakanfo is the Balogun. He acts as the Balogun. That is, when there is war, he is a lord at war.
Okay.
So every Alaafin must have the Bashorun and must have an Are Onokakanfo. And because the Are Onokakanfo is always heady and can be very stubborn, he is not in the capital, that is Oyo. He is always chosen from a nearby town that pledges allegiance to Oyo Empire. For instance, we had Kurumi, who is one of the most popular Are Onokakanfo we've ever had. Kurumi, but he was from Ijaye, while the Alaafin was in Oyo. And sometimes there are even clashes between the Alaafin and the Are Onokakanfo. For instance, in the case of Kurumi, now this is it. When a king dies, then it wasn't so in the beginning, but later it changed because things changed. You know, the society got corrupted and all that. So when a king dies, the Aremo, his first son, actually dies with him. And that was a very extreme measure to curb corruption because we've had cases of the king's son orchestrating the death of his own father so that he can hasten his own journey to the throne.
Okay.
So wait, when you say he dies with him, do you mean like they kill him?
He's required to commit suicide.
Interesting.
He's required to commit suicide.
Wahala for who be first son,
though. He's required to commit suicide. It wasn't just him, actually. Those closest to the king die when the king dies. So it's just a way of protecting. It was very extreme. very, very extreme.
You protect him with all your life.
Exactly. It was very extreme. So the only way to ensure that these people who are very, we have Areorite, we have Iyale Mole, Abobakun, Olokun Enshin, Aremo. These people are
very... Sorry, what do those words mean?
They are offices, you know. Areorite. Areorite is the king's favorite wife. And that's not...
There's a formal name for it.
Yes, a formal... That's it's an tough. Office, actually. Being the king's favorite wife.
So not first wife, but favorite wife. Wow.
Not first wife, but the favorite
Sorry
wife.
Sorry to that first wife, whoever she is. Sorry to her.
But it's not really an enviable position anyway, because she has to die when the king dies too. So.
Okay. I will have the most tank behavior because ain't nobody dying with you.
Everybody dies. So the favorite wife can be used to harm the king. And so the only way to prevent that from happening is by letting her know that she will die if anything happens to the king. And being the favorite wife then is not just, you know, being the favorite wife then meant responsibility. There were some districts in her own care, and she could actually access the king at any time. She was the only person, apart from the Iyale Mole. Iyale Mole is the king's own, like the official mother of the king.
What is the official mother? Is that not the actual mother?
No. The actual mother of a king is usually not alive. And when, even if she's alive, she's kept very far away. Because the thing is this, a king is an Orisha. So the king must not actually bow down for anybody. And it is a taboo for the mother to bow down for the son. You understand? So the king cannot bow down for the mother, and the mother cannot bow down to the son.
They're stuck in a bowing wall.
So the only way to stop that from happening is to keep them far apart. But usually the king's mother was always dead before the man becomes.
He's appointed anyways.
Exactly. So but then we have an official mother called Iyaoba, who also acts as Iyale Mole. That is Imole. Imole is a Yoruba word for deities. You understand? Irumole. I don't know if you've heard that before. Irumole.
I've heard.
So we have Irumole, which is shortened to Imole. So that woman also dies with the king too, because she could access the king at any time. She has almost uninterrupted access to the king at any time. The Olokunrenshin, the same thing. The Aremo, the same thing. These people have a lot to gain from the sudden death of the king. So the only way to curb that is to kill. It was very extreme, but it was very effective. So
they essentially kill anybody that might have a lot to gain from the king's passing.
Yeah, exactly. So even if the king died from natural causes, they were still going to die.
Oh, wow.
Right. Interesting.
And that was what led to the Kurumi War, the Ijayi War. There's a war, a very major war in Yoruba land, which actually was one of the things that shaped us into what we are today. There is this Ijayi War. Kurumi was from Ijayi, and there was an Alaafin Atiba who didn't want his own son to die when he died. You understand? He wanted his own son to be king after him. And that was taboo then. Because if that was a tradition, Atiba himself would not have become king. Atiba himself wasn't the former king's son. He was appointed by the Oyomesi. Now, you can't change that. And that was Kurumi's argument. Kurumi was the Are Onokakanfo. He was the freed marshal of the kingdom. So he posited that the king's son must die after him, just as the former king's son died with the father. And that led to a war. But Kurumi lost. Mm-hmm. And so ever since that time, we've had the Aremo becoming king after the father. But then things have got corrupted today. And so it's not like that anymore. We now have a lot of families always lining up for their turn. So if you are the king's son today, you are just king's son in name. It doesn't mean you are going to be the king after him, because another family is waiting to be king after your father dies.
So my two questions are, so before, when it wasn't like, you know, the first son that would become king, who will become king? And now, how does it work if it's just like random families that are coming into play? So would it just be like a political...
Because isn't there there's a group of people that appoint the king, right? Within
the Oyomesi, that's the job of the Oyomesi.
Yeah.
They appoint the king, but they always keep it in the royal family.
Mm.
So it could be the king's uncle or his brother or whatever, but it just have to be in that family.
Oh, okay. Okay. So now that it's like whatever family, how is it happening? Like, who's appointing who? I don't get...
No, it's not. I mean, it's so dark and dirty today that almost synonymous with the Nigeria's federal politics. You know, so for instance, the Alaafin has died for several months now, and there has not been a new Alaafin because the matter is so hot. It's so hot, and people are already killing themselves over who is going to be the next king.
Seriously.
So exactly. Wait, is it that like a random family can just wake up and say, oh yeah, I have money, I want to be the next king?
That is what it has become now.
That's really? Mad, mad.
That's what it has become now. So these kings actually don't have their relevance, is not there anymore. When you are an Alaafin in those days, you're actually powerful.
It means less, yeah, right now.
You're actually powerful. But now we are just there for nominal effects. You're just there to dress and to spend money, and they really don't make any decision to that affects people's political life anymore. Then even as recently as the 1960s, we still had very powerful monarchs in Yoruba land. But now, you know, they don't even command respect from anybody except those that want to curry some favors from them.
So when did this change? Did it change with the onset of colonization, or what
was it more globalization? Like what? Yeah.
Maybe the fall of the Oyo Empire? I don't know. Like, yeah, when did it change?
As much as I have to admit that there were some good things, a few good things that came with colonialism, the truth is so many evils came with it. A lot of evil came with colonialism. And even if not directly, although many of them were direct, but even implicitly, the fact that our traditions were jettisoned alone did us a lot of harm. For instance, Eshu, if you want to call the devil in Yoruba now, you will say Eshu.
Eshu.
You understand? But then Eshu is not the devil. Eshu is not Satan. Eshu has been existing in the Yoruba among the Yoruba people for centuries before they came in contact with the white man. And in the Yoruba cosmology, we don't believe in that personality called the devil. It just doesn't exist in our own worldview. We see things quite differently from the westernized world. We don't believe in hellfire, for instance. It's not in the Yoruba belief system. Mm-hmm. So our own is a little more complex and even simpler, as complex as it is. So colonialism brought a lot of changes with it. It brought with it the tendency to disregard our own culture. You know, you no longer see our culture. There are some things that are no longer considered sacred anymore. We now talk anyhow. We talk about some things anyhow. We now cast our own deities in a very dark light. We talk about Ogun and Oya as diabolical symbols. And that alone actually did a lot of damage to our psychology as Black people, as Yoruba people. Our politics got very corrupt, sincerely. And that's just simply, and now this is not, this is all not all due to colonialism. For instance, I keep telling people that colonialism was as successful as it was. First of all, slavery was as successful as it was because it had the lucrative connivance of our own monarchs themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They were eager, you know, because they had some things they were gaining from it. It was very lucrative.
Like mirrors.
sadly. So Yoruba would say that if there's no crack in the wall, the lizard will not find its way into it. That's just, if something is that successful, it means the people actually allowed it. You know, the powerful ones among them allowed it. For instance, when slavery was banned, when it was abolished, and it wasn't abolished because the white people had a change of heart. No, it was abolished because it was no longer useful to them. They had, you know, machines that replaced human labor, manual labor, and all that.
Industrialization,
so
bandits, yeah.
I mean, they try to advertise it as them having a change of heart, and it's a lie. And what they did later was worse. I mean, they abandoned slavery for colonialism, which was worse. You know, instead of shipping the people to their own land, they now ship themselves to the land of the people and were governing them in their own lands, which was worse than slavery. But then the point is that it was that successful because the people allowed it. They wanted it. They gained from it. Slavery existed in Africa too, but it wasn't for economic reasons. It was just for personal prestige, private prestige. We had powerful people who had slaves. Kings had slaves. But it never existed as a way of generating revenue for a country. It is the Western world who had that. They had, fascism. They had feudalism, and it just transformed into slavery when they came in contact with the Black people. And if you study the way these people came into our lands and how they gained so much prominence on our lands, it was because of the very corrupt monarchs we had then. We have to say it's very, very corrupt kings we had then. How these white people were able to do shady business with us, the Unilever, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Jaja of Okobo and this white companies about palm oil and all that. It was all because the kings themselves were gaining some things from it. And then when they fought back, most times they weren't fighting back because of the people. It was to secure their power. It was to not lose their influence and all that. So it's intertwined. I would say that colonialism did a lot of damage to us. And it wasn't all negative, really. It wasn't all negative, but most of it was very, very negative. But it was because of the lucrative connivance of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Question, because you had spoken about there were already systems to check those power balances in place. So was it that as of the time colonial persons were arriving, was it that those checks and balances, even within the Yoruba kingdom, already started to kind of weaken? Because I would imagine that if a king is, you know, doing these things for his own benefit, essentially. There were, like you spoke about, I don't know the Yoruba terms now, but then there were groups and of people that would check them, and groups of people that would check those people as well. So I wonder, like, is it that maybe things were already starting to kind of fall apart a little bit within the kingdom before colonial masters arrived? Do you know anything about that?
Okay. The British colonial government was very, very savvy. They were genius when it came to ruling a people, when it came to conquering a people. They had this thing, what they called divide and rule. They literally divided the people and they were ruling them as separate entities. Yeah, when they had done a good job at that, they now amalgamated the people as one. First of all, they divided the people. You see, when corruption is cancerous. When it is introduced into anything, you just give it time. That thing is going to decay. And that's why it's called corruption in the first place. You understand? So I said earlier that a king couldn't be despotic, but with the connivance, with the cooperation of the Oyomesi, it could be very despotic. And we had a lot of people like that, even way before colonial influence. We had so many. There was a king called Oyabi. We had Alaafin Abiodun. Okay, Alaafin Abiodun was peaceful, but we had Bashorunga, you know, Afonja. These were warlords. These were very powerful people. This was even before white influence and all that. And they were very, very despotic. How much more when they had mirrors to gain from it, when they had gunpowder to gain from it, understand? When they had slaves and a lot of money to gain from it. So although there were checks and balances, it was still possible for these very corrupt practices to gain traction because the people were divided, actually. They were divided and were ruled as separate entities. You understand? And that's just it. Once there is division, even if a faction insists on doing things the right way, once major people have been divided, just give it time, the kingdom is going to fall. It's just
That's actually so true. I have a question, I guess, and this goes like a little bit back to maybe like pre-colonial times. I feel like we're making our way forward, but I just want to bring us back a little bit. So I was wondering, because I guess this is something that, like, we've heard like a lot of stories and a lot of non-factual and factual things about this, but like, do you know much about the relationship between the Benin Kingdom and the Yoruba Kingdom? Because there are some people that say, oh, like, you know, some of the Benin people are from the Yoruba. Some people say, oh, Yoruba people are from the Benin people. But based off of my knowledge, I don't think anyone is from each other. I think that Yoruba people just have some Benin blood in them. But also, once again, I am not a historian. So there's a very good chance that knowledge itself is also faulty. So I was wondering how much you knew about the relationship between the Benin Kingdom and the Yoruba Kingdom.
The thing is, it's indisputable that we are siblings of ourselves. The Yoruba and the Beninese are siblings. But now it has become the issue of the chicken and the egg. Which one came before the other?
Which came first?
It's not just Benin people. Even the Shekiri. In fact, the Shekiri is that one is even
like crazy. The Bendels.
Yes, exactly. Go to Wari, for instance. Their language. Wow,
interesting. I thought Shekiri still kind of stemmed from, I don't know why I assumed they stemmed from Igbo people.
No.
Okay,
no. They are pure, it's very obvious that they stem from the Yoruba people. Because if you check their language, just check their language.
Yes. I think the Shekiri language is very similar to the Yoruba language.
Yes, very, very similar. And they call their ruler there Olu, which is a Yoruba word. The Benin is called their ruler Oba, and that is a Yoruba word. They say Ishe, and that is, when they pray, they say Ishe, which is very similar to Ashe, the Ashe in Yoruba land. Well, I'm still looking into it. I'm still trying to get, I'm very interested in that, actually. I want to know how it happened, which one came before the other. Because the Benins were actually very powerful, equally as powerful as the Yorubas. The Oba of Benin was actually an emperor too, just as the Alaafin was an emperor. You understand? And but one thing is, even in those days, before an Oba is chosen in the Benin Kingdom, they actually come to Ife, Ile Ife, and consult Ifa. This is a historical fact. Come to Ile Ife and consult Ifa in Ile Ife. It's like them seeking implicitly, it's like getting approval from Ife or something. Or spiritually, they recognize the influence of Ife over their royal decisions and all that. So the people operated more like brothers than rivals. You understand? Mm-hmm. Even in those days. But it would be guessing to say that the Benins come from the Yoruba. Although we can say that they come from the Yoruba because the Yoruba group is larger. But it's mm-hmm. not that they come in from one or one or that. It's just that they were a product of the same history, a product of the same father. So although the history that we... Although it's not really, it's shallow history. I don't want to consider it an authority. But it is that Oduduwa had sons. One was Oromiyo, and the Oromiyo also had brothers. So the Benin Kingdom was established by one of the brothers of Oromiyo, one of the sons of Oduduwa. But the Benins have a totally different story.
Yeah.
They have a totally different story from that. And you can't say that the Yoruba one is more authoritative. So one has mm-hmm. to just go deep into this thing and understand it. And luckily, I'll be starting my master's program in Yoruba literature very soon. So.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. That's exciting. Yeah. I'm actually so excited. But we're speaking about Yoruba spirituality. I was curious, are you, and I guess I'm not going to make any assumptions, but like, are you, do you belong to any like organized religion? Like, are you Christian? Are you Muslim? Or do you not belong to any of those religions?
Yeah, I'm Christian. I'm Christian, although my own practice of, I'm more liberal in my own Christianity.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay, no, that's fair.
Okay.
But
do you think it's because you know so much about the other religion that makes you loosely feel like it could be anything?
Yeah, okay, let me give you a bit of a background. But my father is Muslim, so I was raised a Muslim.
Okay.
Understand? But my mother is Christian. Mm-hmm. So I had Christian influences too. But I just grew up liking Christianity. The thing is, my father tried to force us to be Muslims. You know, it was very traumatic for us as children. We were flogged, we were whipped to go to mosque. We did all those things. We learned it. You know, we learned the Arabic language, the Quran, the Torah. We did all those things, but not willingly. Our mother, on the other hand, would call us and we just tell us Bible stories. We just, as children, and we just grew up loving Christianity because of the love we had for our mother. So that's just it. I just happen to just like the religion. Although I may not agree with some of the, I don't really agree with a lot of fundamental things in Christianity. Mm-hmm. I don't really. But that doesn't make me less of a Christian. I'm still a Christian, so.
Okay, so how is it like reconciling, I guess, Yoruba spirituality that you know of to not be like, you know, this demonic, evil thing to Christianity, to the Christian religion for you?
Yeah, those who consider...
So sorry, Tayo. Before you actually go into how you reconcile that, because that question is very important, can you actually give us a background on what Yoruba spirituality is and like, and was?
Growing up in my hometown with my grandmother, I saw the thing firsthand, you know, for what it was and for what it is, actually. My grandmother is a Muslim, was a Muslim, but these people, they never abandoned the traditional religion because of the Western religion. They were Muslims, but they still practiced the traditional. They were still Yoruba. It's unlike today that being a Muslim automatically means you can't be associated with anything Yoruba, religiously speaking. And the same thing for Christianity. Yeah. But then they used to say that Imole Onikamasho, that is Islam, doesn't disqualify us from being Yoruba. So they still participated in. My grandmother used to invite our Babalawo, and we saw everything, the consultation of Ifa. We were very much involved in the. We had our own egungun, our own masquerade in our family. And then it was done mostly by our extended family and all that. But being in my hometown, we were part of the whole thing. We even bought the clothes together. We ate their food together. And my grandmother had sisters who were pure traditionalists. They were not even Muslims or Christians. They were pure traditionalists. In fact, my hometown we have a lot of people who practice the religion there. It is a very major religion there. So I saw the thing, you know, it's very beautiful for me, really. It's very beautiful, the way they do their things, you know. And there was this childlike fascination I had for egungun, for instance, which has never left me. And the way we go into the forest, though, before an egungun comes out, we go to the igbale. Igbale is where the egungun gets dressed up. And being part of the family, I could see those things that a lot of people aren't allowed to see. I could enter the shrines, I could see Oshun, Oya, you know, the Babalawos, and I learned a lot of things. But the thing is, the religion can be very stressful. Very, very stressful. Very, very stressful. They have everything, they do for everything. If you come across a cobweb on your path, you must offer this sacrifice, you must say this thing.
Very like superstitious, I guess.
It's very, very superstitious. So I'm not really a religious person that way. I'm not that religious. I one very important lesson I learned was that you see this religion of the Orisha is good and is bad because people are good. Wow. And bad. It's not about the religion. It's about the people. So we have just as we have very bad Christians today, and we have very good Christians. It would be wrong for me to say that because I've encountered some bad Christians and now generalize it, and I'll say okay, all Christians are bad. Mm-hmm. We have Muslims today that are beheading people, and I have Muslim siblings, Muslim parents that are very peaceful. So how wrong would it be for me to say Islam is bad because we have Boko Haram, for instance? So the religion of the Orisha is good and it is bad. It's not the religion. It is the people. We have very good people that practice it and we have very bad people that practice it. Some use it for evil, some use it for good. It is not about the religion. But the colonization factor is what has allowed us demonize the whole thing generally. For you to be a Christian, you must see these things as demons. While the white people were cutting away our deities to their museums, they were making us believe that these things are demonic. So for Christianity to be successful, the people must first believe that their own thing is evil. Now, there is difference. The Yoruba culture actually differentiates between culture and religion. Being a Christian doesn't stop me from enjoying the chanting of my Oriki, for instance. It doesn't stop me from enjoying the poetry of Ijala. Jala is the hunter song in honor of Ogun. Doesn't stop me from listening to the Oriki of Oshun, and I am Yoruba. You understand? And if these people hadn't come here, I would be worshipping Ogun today. I'll be bowing down for Oshun today.
Sorry to cut you, Tayo, but just for our audience who is not Yoruba or Nigerian, can you explain what like an Oriki is?
Okay, an Oriki is Ori Yoruba is your head, right? Ki. Taban king kong. When they say ki is to greet. But we have ki.
Okay.
Ki is to praise. Oh. You understand? Taban kinyon. Ki means to greet, but ki is to. That's why we have those accents. Ki. They tell us how this one is pronounced and all that. Ki is to praise. So Oriki is basically praising somebody's head. The head here is not the physical one we see. In the Igbo culture, we have chi. Your chi is your personal deity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a personal deity, and we have that in Yoruba. Ori, your Ori is also called Eleda, that is the one who is in charge of your origin. The one who, you know, we say things like Oloriire. Oloriire is a fortunate person, a blessed person. It means that person's Ori is good. So the Ori here is actually your inner head. You understand? Your inner head that guides you. That if anything have evil happens to you, it is believed that your Ori has first allowed it. Or you are not in good terms with your own Ori. Chinua Achebe says something that when a man gets so pride, he challenges his own chi to a personal combat. He said it in Things Fall Apart and that. So that's very similar to the Yoruba belief system. So now, Oriki is Oriki comes in two forms. It could be a praise name and a praise poem. Every child in Yoruba land has a praise name, has an Oriki, an attributive name. Names like Aduke, Ashake is an Oriki, you understand? Mm-hmm. Those are Oriki. But then there is a praise poem that is being recited in order to swell your head, in order to make you, you know, it has both psychological and spiritual effects. For instance, traditionally when somebody gets sick, for instance, there are some times that the Babalawo would prescribe Oriki. So this person, the Ori of this person needs to be praised. Just chant the Oriki and then you see the person
coming alive. A spiritual thing at all. That's interesting.
Oh, there's almost nothing that isn't spiritual when it comes to the Yoruba people. Almost everything has a spiritual significance, which is why many things in the Yoruba traditional religion is superstitious. So, and Oriki is not limited to humans alone. Everything in Yoruba land has Oriki. Insects, animals, plants, lands, cities, places, they all have their Oriki. We have Oriki of Lagos, for instance, Oriki of Ijebu as a people, as a land. We have the Oriki of a king, Alaafin, and that is different from his own Oriki himself, being whoever he is. Maybe he's an Ajawo or Alawo and all that. So everything has an Oriki. And
they have family Orikis too, right?
Yes, family Orikis. Okay. A family must have its own Oriki. And that way, we use it to trace a person's origin. If you get to a place where you are not known, for instance, all you have to do is chant your Oriki for them. They are going to tell you where you are from. They're going to tell you, okay, this is your father. And the way we name, our naming system was, because we didn't practice this, what is being practiced today, that a woman gets married and then changes her name and adopts the husband's name. It's very alien to the Yoruba people. We don't do that. Under no circumstance should anybody answer the name of another person. So your name is...
Let's go. If anyone tells me to change my name, I'll be like, sorry, I'm Yoruba. My people don't do that.
The westernization brought a lot of changes, you know. But in those days, your names are always very unique to you and you alone. It's almost like your fingerprint. Because we have different kinds of names that are given to a child. We have the Abiso name. Abiso name is the normal name that your parent gives to you. Names like Yewande, Temitayo, Shalewa, those are Abiso names. You know, your father or your mother will give you a name that appeals to them, which are always an expression of their wishes towards you. Then we have Amutorunwa names. Amutorunwa means something you brought from heaven, or Run is heaven. So Amutorunwa is to bring something from heaven. So the name you brought from heaven, and that is depending on the circumstances surrounding your birth, how you were born. Were you born with your umbilical cord surrounding your neck? Were you born with your... Are you a bridge baby? Did you come out with your legs? Are you a twin? Are you a triplet or whatever? If you have any weird kind of birth or uncommon kind of birth, there is a name for that kind of child. That is an Amutorunwa name. But not everybody has that. You understand? Mm-hmm. So, and then we have Oriki. Oriki is what I've talked about, your attributive name, your praise name. And then we have Orile. Orile is like a family totem. Orile is a family's emblem. It could be anything. It could be Ogun. It could be Iko, Ogbo. Orile is always attached to the Oriki. I don't know if you've heard people whose names are something like Ajadi Ogbo, Ayoka, Anike Okin. That Okin and Ogbo are the Orile. Now, when you combine your Orile and your Abutuanwa and your Oriki and the Abiso, it is unique to you alone. You can't have another person bearing all those names.
Makes sense.
Just that alone. And when a woman marries, she doesn't drop her own Orile. Her Orile is a family totem. So just by listening to your name, we can say, okay, this is where you're from. And that is the essence of having names. So that purpose is defeated when you drop it for another person's own. It's unimaginable today because, you know, we are now used to the surname system and all that. But in the olden days, it wasn't so.
Question, actually I have a comment and a question. So the comment first, I think it's so crazy that I see how, like, I feel like if assuming other cultures, because I'm not Yoruba, I'm Ibira, so assuming other cultures had a similar kind of system of organization, once something changes, you've literally lost history. Do you get? Because I mean, you can trace history just by the way things are organized, but once that changes, is gone, right? So that's just interesting, just listening to you speak about and also for kids. So if you have it, the kid will have the father's Orile. So I probably butchered that, but would that be the case?
Yes. The Orile is unique to a particular family. That is their own. That is similar to a surname today, but it's not really surname because most surnames are not the names of your own father themselves, but the name of a particular uncle or a prominent person in the family and all that. Orile is determined by Ifa, for instance, or the people's practice, or a diviner, or it's always having it. It doesn't have a spiritual spiritual origin. Maybe because of the history of the old people or their encounters. Are they hunters? Are they farmers? Are they Shango worshippers, whatever. That is always the
what. Oh, so you can marry, you can actually marry someone from the same orile, basically. It's not necessarily your blood. Like it can be like a just a community of people. Is that like, does it still carry? Like, I'm just trying to.
Okay, you can't do. Orile is unique to a particular family. Orile is unique to a particular family. When somebody has your orile, that person is your family member.
Your family. Okay.
Giving incest.
Okay. Makes sense.
I find what you said really interesting, Hadiza, because I also think that even though a lot of people talk about culture right now, I feel like we try to practice our culture, but because a lot of it, we've lost the meaning behind it. I think what we're really practicing is a bastardization of the culture, because we're holding so much onto what we don't understand that it becomes lost in translation. For example, I feel like Yoruba people are very big on respect. But I think respect came with a lot of responsibility that the people that demand respect for right now don't actually portray. So it's like, right now, I feel like respect is just given to anyone, but they don't actually earn it, where I feel like this must have had meaning at some point. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. The thing is, in fact, you rightly said, what we have today is a bastardization of what we used to have. For instance, even we are big on respecting the grizzled ones, the gray hairs. We have if I say it in English, it has lost its meaning.
Say it in Yoruba.
It's a play on word there, Junilo, Juninu. So if I translate it to English, it lost its meaning. But it means that if somebody is older than you, the person can get you lost. That means, it just means that this person has power over you. And a worry is a gray hair, and we revere it, you know. It's a taboo to actually look into the face of an elderly person. You know, we are big on respect. We literally prostrate to human beings. We literally kneel down to human beings, you know. And we even address elderly ones in the plural. You can't address another in the singular pronoun and all that. So, enyi, for instance, is plural, but you use that for one person once the person is older than you. So, we're big on respect. But then this respect was, like you said, earned. And it was reciprocal. It wasn't just the elders being respected. The elders actually respected the younger ones too. We have a proverb that says, just as a child's hand cannot reach the top of the shelf, an elder's hand also cannot enter into a gourd or a calabash. We used to say that it is the union of the child's wisdom and an elderly one's wisdom that actually produced Ile-Ife as a place today. So Ile-Ife is established because of the wisdom of both the child and the elders. And that's a proverb that recognizes the fact that being a child doesn't immune you to respect. Being a child doesn't mean you can be maltreated and all those kind of things. So respect in those days, automatically being old actually puts you in a position to be respected. But then you've got to act respectable. You've got to actually be worthy of the respect you're given. There are so many proverbs, but I'm trying to not reduce my Yoruba, and I don't have a good way of saying them in English. You know, we have some, for instance, now this particular proverb that says "agba okongbon." That means being old doesn't necessarily make you wise. You understand? You can have an old fool. So, and that's the people recognizing the fact that old age doesn't just make you wise automatically. But then, whether an old person is foolish or wise, it is your own duty as a younger person to respect a person, because you want to go old too. You are not excused. You are not, for instance, your father could be wrong, your mother could be wrong. But again, we say that it is not a child's place to tell a mother how to sit properly. He says, when a woman is sitting in a way that exposes her genitals, it isn't the place of a child to say to that mother that, mama, sit properly now. No. Even though the mother is doing something wrong, you are too small to correct her. That is just our culture. That is how we say things. Yeah, it's not you. It's not to be heard from you. The fact that you could say something like that already means you are beginning to get too familiar. You're beginning to see her in a way you're not supposed to see her. So we have elders that are very abusive. We have elders that are very despotic and less worthy of our respect, but we still have to respect them. We still have to respect them. It's just the way it is in Africa. You just have to respect elderly people. It's like this. For instance, there are sometimes, I've had clashes with some elderly people and all that, or anybody who is older than me and them, there's an argument between us. If you take the matter to an elderly person, the person will not scold that elderly person in your presence. You will be excused. You will be excused and then the scolding will be done privately. But as a child, you can be scolded in defense of an elder. So there's just this special way we treat elders in Africa, especially in Yoruba land.
Yeah, I know, in fact, when a child is being buried, their parents cannot be there.
Yes.
Well,
in fact, a child is not buried in the residential areas. You know, children are buried far in the bush.
Really?
Where their parents will never... In fact, the spot of the burial is not earmarked so that the mother may not be tempted to go there. You know, she doesn't even recognize the place. It's a taboo for a woman to see the corpse of her own child.
Why? What's the thoughts behind that?
It's just to protect the woman's psychology. It's just to help her. It's just to help her heal. I don't think it's a good sight, you know, a mother seeing her own son lying dead or her daughter lying dead. So it's just because we being heavily religious, try to make it religious and give religious reasons for it. But I think it's just psychological. You just want to protect the mother. You don't want her to deteriorate. So you don't want her to see the dead body of her own child, especially when the child is just an infant, just, you know, very little. So a mother must not, especially the mother, must not see, and even if she sees the corpse and all that, she must not know where the child is buried.
It's buried.
So mostly, sometimes I don't even bury the child. We always had this, it's called Igbo. Igbo in those days, you know, it's unlike what we call bush today. A bush can still be cleared and, you know, you build your house on it. But there were some lands that were reserved and they were just thick forest and bush. So you just throw the child there. Nobody's intending to go there to build a house. And although today we have houses in probably all of those places now. But then in those days, just leave the bush there and it's dedicated to, you know, throwing of dead bodies, especially infants. We had what we call a biku. A biku is a child born to die. And so that one is another very complex aspect of the Yoruba belief system. But we have a name called Igbe Koyi. Igbe is bush. So Igbe Koyi, it means the bush has rejected this one. And that is a way of saying that this child will not die. Because if the child dies, she will be thrown, or he will be thrown into the bush. So if the bush has rejected this one, it means this person is going to live till old age. So Igbe Koyi, that's a name that gives us an insight into how we treat babies dying in those days.
Okay.
Wow, this is also interesting. Like, I actually just want to keep talking because I'm learning so much and it's actually pretty exciting. But I have a question though. Like, what do you think about the current... I mean, I guess we've already established that nowadays what we're practicing is the bastardization of the, you know, actual culture. But I guess, what do you think of the current, like, preservation of, like, knowledge like this, like, knowledge that you have that is not as easily accessible unless you're, like, raised into it the way you were? What do you think about the current, I guess, preservation of that kind of knowledge and even, like, accessibility of that knowledge?
Yeah, what I desperately wish for is the fusing of our culture with technology. The best way to preserve our culture is by doing things like this, is by creating content on it, is by writing books on it, is by doing films on it, preserving it in technology, sincerely. Because a lot actually is lost. But a serious researcher can't even scratch the surface of what we used to practice. A lot is lost. But we can still glean, we can still gather from these things, you can still get the authentic things, and we just have to recognize the importance of technology. We have to become less oral and more literate, for instance. I have to say that way. So the thing is, 70% of the Yoruba culture and all that is not found in books. 70% is not found in books. You can't be seriously wanting to understand the Yoruba people and you're going to Google, you won't see anything there. And even the ones you see, they are just very watered down versions. You know, even the history of the people. And because we didn't record our history the way other civilizations did. It has allowed the eruption of several versions today. Anybody can just come up and say, okay, this is my own version of history, and that is the correct one. So we have to start the job of correcting those things, preserving our culture in technology. There's nothing that says Ifa cannot be consulted on an iPad, for instance. It's not a taboo. There's nothing that stops Oshun being seen in technology, for instance. A lot of these things, and they get more beautiful actually when they are infused in technology. So that's the best way to preserve our culture for real. That's the best way to preserve, because the Yoruba language and culture, they are intertwined, but they can still be separated. You know, being a Christian has never really discouraged me from wanting to know about Oshun. I'm even fascinated. I love it. And that's because you can love it as your culture. It is your culture. The fact that some people see it as a religion doesn't stop it from being your own culture. You understand? How we do what we do when we give birth to twins. When a twin is born in Yoruba land, it's a big deal, you know, because the twins themselves are considered deities. They are Orisha. We have Orisha Ibeji. You understand? We have Orisha Ibeji, and then, you know, even when other ethnic groups around us were killing twins, we never really killed twins. You know, we've always revered them. We've always worshipped them. We consider them deities, literally. So a lot of all these beautiful things, let us have them in technology. Let us just begin to recognize, appreciate the value of technology in preserving anything.
Yeah, no, I actually think I agree. Because I think, like, even just with the way the world is evolving, obviously, I feel like technology is the way to go with preservation. So that definitely makes sense. But I have another quick question, actually. So I know you said that, like, obviously, if you're trying to, like, you know, get into Yoruba culture or, like, know a lot about Yoruba history, you won't find it in, like, books and stuff like that. But, like, I mean, like, let's whatever say about Yoruba history itself, like, just books about, like, Yoruba culture, movies about Yoruba culture, the 30% that might encapsulate some of it, what are your favorite books or movies that, like, you feel like encapsulate what the Yoruba culture, I guess, even, like, the religion as well, like, just encapsulate, like, what all that is about? It doesn't have to be, like, a historical book that actually says exactly what it's about, just, like, a book that you feel like encapsulates the culture, like a book and a movie, because I'm actually curious, and I'm sure some people out there might be curious to just, like, watch something or want to read something to see, like, you know, this is Yoruba.
Oh, many. Okay, the books in pure Yoruba, for instance, one cannot downplay the importance of D. Ofagunwa. Was a major writer of Yoruba literature. He's written books, and anybody who is familiar with Yoruba literature will know these books. Ogbojo Odenunwegbe Iromole. Those are the books he wrote. Ireke Onibudo.
Please just write that down for me after this. Go ahead.
Igbo Olodumare is also one of the books of D. Ofagunwa. We have Aditu Olodumare. Those are some of his books. And these books have been translated into English by Wole Soyinka. So they are now they're now available for English readership. We have Ogbojo Odenunwegbe Iromole has been translated into The Forest of a Thousand Demons. And then we have In the Bush of Olodumare, In the Forest of Olodumare. Soyinka has translated those works, and those are very, very beautiful. Those are my favorite works. And then even the plays, a lot of the plays of Olarotimi, although they were written in English language, the translation was always very adroit, very beautiful, and it just makes you fall in love with the Yoruba language. The proverbs, the way Olarotimi has decorated those proverbs, the way he translated them into English, and some of the Yoruba songs. And, you know, we have plays like The Gods Are Not to Blame, plays like Kurumi, Ovoramenugbaisi, even though that is Benin, but, you know, it still preserves an aspect of the Benin culture. We've had a lot of, Soyinka has written Death and the King's Horseman, has written The Road, has written Alapata Akpata. And then there is this other playwright. I'm talking about plays a lot because I study theater, so I read so many.
Yeah, that's fair. I love plays too, so we move.
So Femi Osofison, the writer of Women of Owo, you know, he's written so many. Morom Todun. Fiddlers of a Midnight Lark. He's written, there's this other one. And the chattering and the song. So many plays by Femi Osofison, and these are classics. And then we have Wale Ogunyemi. And I mentioned Toyin Fanlola, although Toyin Fanlola doesn't really write fiction. He writes pure historical books. And he's written a history of the Yoruba. There's this one also I would like to recommend by Reverend Johnson, although his own version of history is not loved by a lot of Yoruba people because he was a missionary. And so that influenced...
He had an agenda.
Exactly. That influenced a lot of how we presented us as a people. But then it still retains some authentic history in it. And that's the history of the Yorubas.
So wait, was he Yoruba or was he white?
He was Yoruba. He was Yoruba.
Okay.
But then, we don't know his Yoruba name. It was...
But Ajayi is Yoruba now.
Exactly.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is, like, Ajayi also had agendas.
I used to hate him.
I was calling him Ajayi. It's absolutely sending me because we don't even know him like that.
He did a lot of damage, yo. That man literally,
I feel like you can trace a lot of the way that we look at our culture to, like, his work on, like, translating the Bible. Actually.
In fact, that issue, mistranslation, as I said earlier, is Ajayi's work now. The translation of the Bible.
And I think it was very intentional. I don't even think it was by chance.
All these things were not coincidental. Like I said, it was a part of a system. They used him as a tool. The Bible, the translation of the Bible itself had an agenda. Its job was to present the religion of the people as demonic. So they had to do it intentionally. You know, they had to make Eshu the devil. If you want to convert the people, you have to turn their own thing to bad guys. They needed a bad guy. They needed a devil and Eshu. And in the Igbo land, they used Ekwensu for that too. Ekwensu was turned to the devil, even though Ekwensu has always existed among the Igbo people as a deity that was worshipped by the people, you know. But then if you go to Igbo land today, you want to say Satan in Igbo, you say Ekwensu. Just as you come to Yoruba land, you want to say Satan, you say Eshu. These were the works of Ajayi Crowder. He did a lot of damage. You know, even his description of Egungun. These people, they had a dictionary of Yoruba words, and the intention of that was to just distort everything about the Yoruba religion. Everything. And that is the nature of Christianity, which is why sometimes when I talk about Christianity, I sound like I'm not Christian myself, because we just have to acknowledge the fact that the history of this religion is very dark, very dark, you know, a lot of very evil things, you know, and these were necessary for the success of the religion. You know, it is this big today because of those evils, those crusades, you know, those killings of people, those wars, those burnings of people. Like, we had the Dark Ages, for instance, and that was the time when Christianity was in power politically, and that time was called the Dark Ages. So, it was because a lot of things they did there was dark.
It's the way he said it with such emphasis.
He said dark.
He said Dark Ages.
So these people, I mean, doing a dictionary of the Yoruba people, and literally everything you do, every of the meaning you give are very derogatory, are very condescending. You know, just sometimes I read these words and I'm filled with anger. It is not necessary. But then the nature of the religion, the nature of Christianity is very, for it to arise, other religions must be pulled down. You know, that is the only, and that is what makes the Yoruba religion so unique. And in animist religions generally, religions of African lands generally, you never hear them evangelizing or proselytizing, for instance. You never hear, have you ever been met by an Oshun worshipper, and then he has come to say, okay, I've come to you with the gospel of Oshun. I want you to get converted. they're not after newcomers. They're not after converts. In a family, the child can decide to be an Oshun worshipper. The father worships Ogun. The mother worships Oya. And they live harmoniously. There's no rancor. In fact, they attend each other's festival. You can even say, okay, this child, it looks like the path of this child is different. Okay, let this child start worshipping Oya. Let us change the deity. Different deities in one family, no wahala, no problem. But can we have a Christian family where the father is Anglican, the mother is Catholic, the son is Sele, the other one is Redeemed, one is Deeper Life, in one family? It's not possible. Mm-hmm. You understand? So,
well, I mean, I don't know. I guess, like, it's kind of like the thing you mentioned where it's like, I guess in each religion there will be bad people and there will be good people, but it doesn't necessarily mean that
exactly
this thing itself is bad or good. I think, like, when, you know, politics and world structures kind of come into a thing, it makes everything twisted and corrupt to a degree, but it doesn't mean, like, the fundamentals of it is actually evil, if that makes sense.
Exactly. That's just it. Now, what makes Christianity so dark is because it became political. You know, it became used as a system of government.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had the age of the papacy, the popes and all that, and they did a lot of very bad things. Again, it boils down to the evil of man, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just man being evil, being innately evil. That's just it. That is why the history of Christianity is shrouded in a lot of very, very tragic events. You know, there was a time I was very uncomfortable with being a Christian because I'm African and I know how these religions, into Africa. I wasn't considering myself because it was difficult for me to reconcile the fact that I am a Christian and I am a black person at the same time. I know what these people did to us. I know how it came. I know how it got so entrenched in our society. I know what they did. I know how they saw us. But then when you begin to go into history, you realize that, okay, we had the missionaries who actually were different from the colonialists. You know, although, mm-hmm. especially the 19th century missionaries, earlier versions of the missionaries actually worked hand in hand with the colonialists. It was, in fact, the missionary was needed for colonialism to succeed. You need to steal the people's religion from them. That is the only way they can be colonized. There's nothing that gives people a sense of purpose more than their religion or their culture. When you have taken that away from them, the whole building comes crashing down. So the missionaries were necessary for that, you know, and many of them were racist and all that. But then the later ones we had that were very instructive for our history as Yoruba people, they actually came out of the pure intention to just spread the gospel of Christ. They were just worshiping their own God. They were just obeying the Great Commission. They just wanted to preach. They just wanted to get people converted. And some good things can be traced to them, for instance. You know, we have universities, we have schools today because of the missionaries. The colonialists never wanted us to get industrialized. And we are not industrialized today. But the little ones we have, the little education we have today, the little Western influences we have today that are helping us was due to the influence of the missionaries. You understand? So one has to just make peace with the fact that even the evil, the few evil things or the many evil things that were done was because of the connivance of of our own ancestors, as I have said earlier. And that just helps you to just, okay. And because I love Islam, because I love the Ilaya, all my childhood experiences were surrounded around Islam and all that. My father is Muslim, my uncle, all my relatives and all that. But I grew up loving Christianity, you understand? Mm-hmm. And I can't go into the Yoruba religion because it is so stressful for me, really. I can't. It's too stressful. It's too That's stressful. Your hindrance. And yeah, and offering of sacrifices, you know, all these things are not, naturally, I can't do all these things. I don't have...
So I don't have energy.
I don't have the energy for sacrifice. Can I do not teach me well?
I don't have the energy for all those kind of things. So I always feel very at home with Christianity. You know, I just love the religion, for real. And it in no way makes me feel less of a black person. No. It doesn't affect who I am as a black person. No. Christianity has now become something global. So, associating with it. And it helps to see that even some of the people I respect were Christians. Not only like Nelson Mandela, as African as he was a Christian. But then he didn't allow his own Christianity to affect his black mentality. He was still a black man, still had his black pride. And that's enough for me, for real.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jinx.
That's a good roundup. I really, really wish we could go on. But as you said, like, even historians can't even scratch the surface of what it was. So we're definitely not going to be able to put that into a podcast as well.
Definitely.
But we really, really appreciate your knowledge that you've given us. And we'd like to know more about where we can find you, because I know you also drop a lot of nuggets on your social media accounts. So let us know where we can find you and learn some more.
Yeah, for now, I'm still restricted to my social media platforms. I'm working on having a website. And I'm an artist too. I draw, and so I want to preserve a lot of visual art and all that. So I'm still a work in progress. Just getting started, actually. There's still a lot to be done. You know, there's still a lot of organization to come into what we do. And with time, we're going to get there. So for now, I'm just on social media.
So what is your handle?
Bato Inspiration_ on Instagram. Bato Inspiration on TikTok, on Instagram. Bato Inspo on Twitter. Bato Inspiration on YouTube. Bato Inspiration on Facebook too.
So Bato is B-A-T-O, right?
Yeah, Bato Inspiration.
Okay.
All right. And we're going to drop all those handles in our description so you can check that if you can't spell it or whatever. Okay. How about your art? Where can we find your art?
Yeah, I still have a lot of them have not been publicized, but I'm still working on, because I want to create a website for it, but I'm going to be sharing them on my Instagram very soon. But I'm still working on having an online gallery and a lot of these things.
Oh.
Yeah. So when it is done, I'm going to let you know.
Nice. Hadiza is also, Dizzy is also into art as well. She has a website too, so that's really nice.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure she can relate.
No, you know, this is different because I feel like his own will have deep, more meaning. Rich, it will be deep, you know. Mine is just aesthetics.
Yeah, I'd like but to definitely. See some of your works though.
Okay, yes, I will follow.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Tayo. We really, really had a fun time.
Yeah, this was so great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And as you always say, washeri.
Washeri.